Before we go to look at what's meant by illicit financial flows, let's talk about the context a bit. So the United Nations have now recognised that reducing and eventually eliminating illicit financial flows is absolutely key to ensuring good governance and getting the cash that governments need to achieve the Sustainable Development Goals.
Yeah, well, the Sustainable Development Goals, which were adopted in 2015 by the world communities through the United Nations, depend quite importantly on what they call domestic resource mobilization. That is that countries shouldn't be dependent, developing countries in particular, on external aid, but on their domestic resources as far as possible. And a key element of that is staunching the bleeding, staunching the flow of illicit funds that leave many developing countries. So the term illicit financial flows was used to cover all of those types of outgoing flows of money. And in the Addis Ababa Action Agenda, adopted again by the United Nations at a meeting in Addis Ababa on financing for development, the aim of reducing and eventually eliminating illicit financial flows was established as a target.
The words illicit financial flows gets used a lot, so let's talk about what they actually mean. The first point is probably to say that offshore is absolutely key, but also that you're talking about not just the concealing of the proceeds of crime or corruption, not just tax evasion, but also you say that includes tax avoidance and tax planning, hiding wealth from public agencies, business associates or family members.
Yes, the term illicit, I think, was used deliberately to cover a wide range of the kinds of flows that all use the same facilities. So obviously it starts at one end of the spectrum from concealing the proceeds of crime or of corruption. So this may be organised crime, small crimes, any crimes that use the facilities of offshore, corruption as well. That's at the one end of the spectrum. At the other end, there are activities that are put forward as being perfectly respectable, such as the need to hide your wealth from, for example, business associates or family members. Well, some people may think these are acceptable, but to do it in this secretive way, I think, still comes within the term illicit. And then in the middle, and that's our concern, obviously, as Tax Justice Network, in the middle are two types of flows that involve losses of tax to countries. One is tax evasion, which is criminal activities, concealing your income so as not to have to pay tax. And the other is tax avoidance and tax planning. So there's all those activities that fall within the term illicit. I think the reason why this broad term illicit was used was that all of these kinds of flows make use of the same facilities, the so-called offshore tax haven and financial secrecy system. The two go together, tax avoidance and financial secrecy. And offshore is generally a murky sort of place. And the reasons for that are the features of offshore. Firstly, obviously, the opacity. Murkiness is due to secrecy rules, where jurisdictions have often quite strong protections, amounting even to criminal sanctions for anyone who breaks commercial confidentiality. And the unwillingness of offshore centres to share information internationally. The next feature of offshore, which makes it murky, is that the structures used are complex. Offshore isn't just one place, and it's not just a small island with palm trees, but it's a network of jurisdictions, so that the use of the offshore system generally involves using chains of entities. They may be companies or trusts or other legal entities, and commonly what's done is to use a chain of them. So you would set up a front company, a paper company in one jurisdiction and have a bank account in a different one. Or even have a chain of ownership through a chain of companies in different jurisdictions. And the complexity of it makes it hard for authorities, in particular tax authorities, to penetrate. That's the second feature. The third feature is that offshore often depends on the problems of interpreting concepts, particularly concepts such as residence. You can exploit, especially the residence of legal entities like companies. Countries have different definitions of when is a company considered resident. In some countries, a company is resident if it's formed under the laws of that country. In other countries, it's only resident if it's managed from that country. So that there are difficulties and divergences in interpretation, and by playing one off against the other, again, that contributes to the murkiness of offshore. The fourth element is the difficulty of penetrating these murky arrangements is all the more difficult because the authorities, the tax authorities or the anti-money laundering authorities, generally are short of resources, particularly compared to the resources that the wealthy and large companies can get on their side. So the authorities, the enforcers of the rules, are outgunned at almost every turn. And it becomes hard for them really to get enough people, time and information really to track down a lot of these activities. And finally, we shouldn't forget, I think, the fact that often those authorities, the officials concerned, don't get very strong political support for vigorous enforcement. Often there's an ideology that somehow the wealthy shouldn't be taxed because that's a disincentive to investment. There's an emphasis on the need for investment and growth. So often it's thought that if you're pursuing the rich and the powerful, that will somehow discourage them from investment, which creates jobs. And I think it's that political aspect that also contributes to the difficulty of penetrating the murkiness of this offshore system.
Right. And if we talk about tax evasion and tax avoidance, which is often defended and reported on by journalists as being legal, you know, it does assume a legality that we really can't be sure of, since it's either kind of shrouded in secrecy or it's just not been challenged legally in a court of law for some of the reasons you've just explained. So talk us through some of the way that you see that difference.
Well, there's a murky line, again, a blurred line, let's say, between criminal tax evasion and tax avoidance. Criminal tax evasion is hard to prove because to prove someone guilty of a criminal offence obviously has a much higher standard of proof, but also in particular you have to show willfulness and intent. So it's not enough simply to show that tax was not paid when it should have been paid. You have to prove that the person concerned actually knew that and intended it. And that's often hard to prove. There was a famous case in Britain, for example, when the comedian Ken Dodd was prosecuted, and the Revenue had quite strong evidence. But he was a well-known figure. He kind of joked in court, got some people to say what a wonderful chap he was, and he basically joked his way out of it and said, oh, he relied on his accountants. And that's often, obviously, what rich and wealthy people do, rely on their accountants or lawyers. So it's hard to show that they knew that they weren't paying tax when they should have been paying tax. Criminal evasion, usually speaking, it's if people don't declare income that should have been declared. That's the situation where you might be able to prove evasion. But the second area I think is quite important to point out is that even if you can't prove that someone knowingly didn't pay tax when they should have paid it, that doesn't mean to say that the non-payment of tax is perfectly legal. It's particularly the large corporations, the multinational corporations, that say that their tax avoidance arrangements are perfectly legal. Well, that's clearly not the case, because many of their arrangements, if they are challenged by the revenue authorities, the tax authorities, are proved to be not valid, not lawful. And in that case, they weren't perfectly legal. I mean, what can be said is it's hard, again, to prove that the people who devised those arrangements did so in any illegal way, but nevertheless, the tax avoidance arrangement proved not to be valid was not perfectly legal.
Right, and that takes us to your point that you make, why these multinational companies are using offshore in the first place. You know, they're using it to try to get around a law that they don't like in the place where they're actually based. If these activities are legal, then there's no need to carry them out offshore.
Yes, if we go back to the offshore being a system, again, people argue that activity that is not unlawful and the other kind of dubious activities we talked about, concealing your wealth from business associates or from your partners or family, why shouldn't people do that? Well, the point is that they can do that within the law in the country where they live. There is protection of confidentiality. You can set up a trust in your own country. There's no need to go to another country. The point about offshore is that you're using facilities provided by another country, usually systematically, to attract bank accounts and to attract company formation by non-residents. So the whole offshore system is based on this concept that a country can hold itself out by offering these facilities specifically and deliberately to non-residents to attract their bank account deposits or their company account formation. So therefore, they're taking advantage of a law when they could, if they think that their activity is perfectly legal, they could probably do it at home. They're taking advantage of a law which is available to them in a different country, which presumably isn't available to them at home. So that's why I think it should be described as illicit, undesirable, that a person living in one country can take advantage of the laws of another country effectively to defeat enforcement of the law in the country where they're normally resident or living.
Okay. What people would argue is, and especially people in the industry, is that these jurisdictions are offering services that they can't otherwise get, which I guess it takes you around to the idea of people, some people being able to go shopping and others not, which is obviously fundamentally unfair if they're able to circumvent the laws in their own country.
Yes, that's a big feature of offshore, basically, that it's jurisdiction shopping. It's shopping for a law that gives you some advantages against the law of the country where you're normally living. And in relation to tax, obviously, that's quite important. Now, it's sometimes said that you need to do that if you're conducting some kinds of international activity. An example, obviously, is investment funds. Many investment funds use offshore centres as a place of formation. We saw in the Paradise Papers recently, for instance, that the Queen was found to have had a little bit of her money without her knowledge by her investment advisors in an investment fund in an offshore jurisdiction. Well, those funds say, well, what they're doing, creating the fund in that jurisdiction, is not illegal and it doesn't involve criminality. Well, not by them. Certainly they may be allowed to set up an investment fund there. There are rules about whether they can offer it to residents of other countries. But the point is that the reason that they choose these jurisdictions is because that can then attract deposits, attract investors who may not be so above the law. It depends. If you're an investor in an investment fund, when you get a payout, you're supposed to declare that payout in your home country and pay tax on it. And by setting up in an offshore jurisdiction, which does have secrecy, which may not have exchange of information arrangements with every country in the world, you're encouraging investors to invest in it who may themselves not want to pay tax. So the investment fund, although itself probably legal, is colluding in illegal and probably criminal activity, tax evasion.
Until quite recently, tax authorities couldn't even obtain information from abroad, from these secrecy jurisdictions, and some developing countries still face really big challenges in that area, right?
Yes, it's as a result of public pressure in which Tax Justice Network has contributed. There's been a lot of pressure on political leaders, and since 2009, not that long ago, they started an international effort, first of all, to establish automatic exchange of information between countries, and finally, countries like the UK started putting pressure on the offshore jurisdictions to participate in this automatic exchange of information. One of the important financial centres, which is not normally thought of as offshore, is the United States. Now, the United States, although under a Democrat administration, it did take an important initiative in passing the Financial Accounts Tax Corporation Act, FATCA, in 2010, but still that's on a bilateral basis. The United States hasn't joined the arrangements for multilateral automatic exchange of information. And the bilateral arrangements which the United States has concluded aren't with all countries, so many developing countries are still left out, and they aren't always reciprocal. The United States wants to get information from other countries about US taxpayers, but it's not always willing to give information to those countries, which makes the United States, to some extent, a secrecy jurisdiction. So the effort is there. This year, we have the first automatic exchange of information between around 40 countries, I believe. Next year, a number more jurisdictions are going to start actually exchanging the information. So we're on the first steps of a quite long road. But at least the automatic exchange of information, which the Tax Justice Network started to campaign for over 10 years ago, and at that time was considered really a dream, has been accepted as the international standard. But the next step, apart from making this universal and getting the United States to join properly, the next step is to obtain the information. Authorities can only exchange information that they already have. That means that the beneficial ownership of bank accounts and of companies and trusts needs to be known. And so far, we're at the very early stages of countries committing to have adequate arrangements for beneficial ownership of legal entities to be known, so that there would be information to exchange.
Right. And obviously you get to the point where even in very wealthy so-called developed countries, mounting a legal challenge against the likes of, you know, huge multinational companies is very difficult.
Yes, and another arrangement which would improve the ability of authorities really to penetrate the murky world of offshore would be to have a requirement for tax planning schemes to be notified to the authorities. Now, a number of countries established this, for example, the UK, because the UK had such an endemic problem of systematic tax avoidance going back two or three decades already. The UK authorities brought in a disclosure scheme, but that was aimed at domestic tax avoidance and aimed at marketed schemes. It's only more recently that attention has shifted to requiring notification of so-called tax planning scheme, tax avoidance, which may be not off-the-peg marketed schemes, but usually multinationals use tailor-made schemes, and they usually are rather different. So notably this year, we have, I think, the first ever proposal for a law for notification of cross-border tax avoidance schemes, even if they're not necessarily marketed, but tailor-made schemes. And this is one within the European Union, put forward by the European Commission in June this year, which is currently being debated in the European institutions. Now, that will be a major step forward. We hope that that will go through. But in addition, again, looking at the UK experience, after the UK introduced a disclosure scheme, it found that that really was not sufficient, because disclosing, tax planners can just keep rolling out new schemes, disclose them if they fall within the definitions of what it needs to be disclosed. But then that means that the revenue just have a lot more work to do to unravel those schemes and then to challenge them if they think they can be challenged under the law. And in the meantime, the taxpayer is saving tax. So the UK introduced a so-called accelerated payment scheme where they can have a quick look at the notified scheme, and if they think it's unlikely to succeed, you have to pay the tax up front and then argue about it. So it's only if the revenue loses that they pay back the money. So I think that that's an important, and that's been very successful. I think that's more successful in the UK in a way than the initial notification scheme. And then thirdly, again, the UK very recently introduced a procedure for penalties for enablers of schemes if they are found to fail, if they're not successful avoidance schemes. Now, as a result of lobbying by the tax advice industry, that was rather watered down, so it only applies to abusive schemes, which is very narrowly defined. But I think that's a procedure that a country should consider, making it an offence to devise a scheme which turns out not to be valid.
Right. And in the end, what we have is quite a messy international tax system because it's so broad in terms of the criteria, so subjective in terms of the interpretation, and difficult to tackle because it's really, as you say, become dysfunctional.
Yes, sir. The international tax system contributes, if you like, to the murkiness of the offshore system because it has a lot of grey areas. The grey areas in international tax are quite large. And the particular one, I think, is transfer pricing. Now, there, people don't always make a clear enough difference between two categories of problems. Sometimes the term transfer mispricing is used, and estimates are made about how much transfer mispricing there is. And that would refer to a situation where you have an exporter in one country, an importer in another country, and so the transaction between them is a transfer. There's a sale of goods and services and a payment. And transfer mispricing will be where they agree to have an invoice which is less than the actual price paid, and then the difference would be paid to an offshore account. That's a fairly simple and probably common example of transfer mispricing. Now, that would be pretty clearly illegal, because what the aim would be probably to pay less import duty. If you're invoicing for less than the actual price, your import duty would be less, and you might also be evading exchange controls. If the money's deposited in your Swiss bank account or wherever it may be, if the importer's country has exchange controls, they would automatically get Swiss francs without going through the exchange control. So that will be transfer mispricing. And estimates are made of the extent of that by looking at trade data, not trying to find mismatches of trade data between the two countries. Now, that's transfer mispricing. But in international tax law, the category of transfer pricing more commonly applies to where a multinational corporation has transactions between its various affiliates, its various subsidiaries or branches. Multinational corporations are internationally integrated. Often they have transfers between them. If you think of a large automobile company, for example, it will have assembly plants in a few countries and then components manufacturing plants owned by the same company, say an engine plant, possibly in a different country. So the engine built in one country, which is transferred to the assembly plant in another country, that would be a transfer, and there would be a payment made between the two subsidiaries. Now, the issue there is that there is no clear price. It's not like an independent importer and exporter. They are part of the same firm, and the firm sets the price. But under international tax rules, that poses a problem, because the entities in the two different countries are taxed by two different tax authorities, and they look at the accounts of the subsidiary in their own country. So the subsidiary in that country has to show an import price, let's say. So the price it shows is the transfer price. But tax authorities have the power to adjust the profits made by looking at that price and saying, well, is that price the right price, the correct price? And the international standard that's been developed is the standard of what would it be if they had been independent. Now, that poses a lot of problems, because the very reason for the existence of multinationals is that they can make extra profits by operating these activities in an integrated way. If it was more profitable to buy an engine from an independent company, they would do it that way. But it's the fact that they can combine the two activities that makes it extra profitable. So this independent entity principle, or the so-called arm's length principle, in practice doesn't work terribly well. And it gives companies a lot of leeway, not only when we're talking about transfers of physical goods, like my example of the engine, but loans. Companies lend. Usually a multinational company will have a central treasury which will extend finance to its different affiliates, and it can easily load those affiliates up with debt. The interest on that debt is deductible, and that will reduce the tax payable by that affiliate. So there are a lot of practices like that where internationally integrated multinationals can take advantage of pricing in a way that reduces taxable profit of their various affiliates. And it's hard to show that that is deliberate evasion, because they operate within the great deal of leeway that's given to them by the transfer pricing rules.
Right, and there's a good example of that with Starbucks, quite a famous one.
Yeah, so a well-known example, I think, was a few years ago when, it was 2012, was it? When a newspaper report showed that Starbucks, obviously the well-known coffee chain, in the UK had paid hardly any tax since it started in the UK in 1998. I think it was just in 1 year it had paid about $8 million in tax, but despite selling, it's estimated from 1998 through to 2012, around £3 billion worth of coffee and whatever else, despite setting up over 700 outlets, and despite having an operating profit margin of as much as 15%, it inconsistently declared losses. On the one hand, it was telling its shareholders how well the British operation was going, how it was booming and expanding and doing very well. But to the tax authorities, it said, terribly sorry, the trading conditions in the UK are not very good and we made a loss yet again. So that rather startled people. When people dug into it a bit more closely, it seems from the reports, although we don't have any inside information, but from published information and newspaper reports, it seems that the reason was Starbucks in the UK was paying for intellectual property rights at the rate of 6%. Now, this is a common way in which multinationals reduce taxable profits. They do depend on various kinds of intellectual property rights. Obviously, in the case of Starbucks, quite importantly, the brand name and the logo. Now, here, unfortunately, international tax rules accept the mythical notion that these are somehow owned by one of the Starbucks affiliates. The reality, anyone who knows about intellectual property knows that these intangibles are exactly what they say, intangibles. The value of a brand like Starbucks really depends on the reliability of its products, which depends on all the outlets. If the UK outlets were to fall down on the trustworthiness of their standards and the customer experience, then the value of the brand would drop. But still, international tax rules accept the notion that the brand is owned somewhere by another Starbucks affiliate, so that the British activity has to pay, and it paid at the rate of 6%. Now, 6%, transfer pricing experts say, is at the top end of the acceptable range. Applying the independent entity principle, arm's length principle, the tax authorities are supposed to say, well, what would an independent coffee chain pay for a well-known brand? Well, in practice, a small coffee shop on the corner just relies on its own customer service and friendliness to the customers to develop its brand. So it's very hard to find what a royalty rate for a well-known brand should be. And 6% apparently is at the high end. But that makes a massive difference. If Starbucks only paid 3 or 4% for the brand, Starbucks UK, then it obviously would have made a consistent profit. So for what reason, I don't know what the reason was, the British Revenue Authorities didn't challenge the 6% rate, and that apparently was the main reason. There may have been some other reasons also to do with how they were pricing the coffee that they bought from another Starbucks affiliate. Now, what was surprising was that after the newspaper reports, Starbucks said, and obviously this was because of the fearing blowback from its customers, and I think a boycott did start, oh, well, we'll adjust things. First of all, they said, well, we'll make a voluntary contribution of $20 million a year in tax. And then after a year or two, they reorganized their activities to regularize that so that they would pay a reasonable level of tax in the UK. So that shows, on the one hand, that the activity wasn't perfectly legal. Starbucks could have decided to pay 4% royalty instead of 6% royalty from the start, but they didn't. But what was then interesting was, possibly as a result of this publicity, that the European Commission decided to get in on the act. The European Commission challenged it and found that the payments that were being made were being paid to the affiliate of Starbucks in the Netherlands. And there they'd got a tax break from the Dutch authorities, so that the bulk of those payments were not paying tax. So not only was Starbucks reducing the tax it paid in the UK, it wasn't paying tax on those same payments in the Netherlands either. Now, the European Commission said, well, this is a breach of EU state aid rules. And they've ordered Starbucks to repay between 20 and 30 million euros. Now, that's under appeal. But there again, that shows that Starbucks' activity was not perfectly legal. It certainly went to the edge of the law in the UK, but it seems to have broken the law under European law. So the activities that claim to be perfectly legal are not necessarily legal. But what I would go back to is why they should come under the term illicit financial flows is that they use the same techniques. They use the same techniques as evasion. And they use these chains of companies, one hiding behind the other. They use the murkiness of the system. We found recently, for example, in the Paradise Papers, not only did we find about the Queen having small investments in offshore funds, offshore investment funds, but we found that Apple, after its arrangements in Ireland had been challenged, shopped around for another jurisdiction to switch its activities through, and did more or less a beauty parade and wrote to a lot of jurisdictions with a questionnaire saying, well, what can you offer us? Can you offer us a guaranteed low tax rate? And Jersey apparently won this beauty parade. So Apple set up an affiliate in Jersey, which obviously is known for being a facilitator of these kinds of murky chains of companies. But so is the Netherlands, although the Netherlands isn't thought of as a palm fringe tax haven. Nevertheless, for multinational companies, its facilities operate in the same kind of way. They offer, in particular in relation to intellectual property management, they offer the same kinds of facilities to make it easier for multinational companies to dodge taxes in other countries in a way that isn't always legal.
That leads me to think that the way that we're measuring these illicit financial flows, we must be underestimating by quite a lot on that basis of how they're defined.
Well, there are different estimates made of the different components. Now, estimating them is not my speciality. I'm not an economist. Obviously, by its very nature, the fact that this is a murky system, getting decent estimates is difficult. You have to use indirect methods. But that is what is now being debated. Some argue that in defining illicit flows and in estimating the quantity, you shouldn't include activities that are legal. Well, what I've tried to argue here is that you need to look at all the categories because they all use the same system and they all use the same kinds of facilities, and also because it's hard to draw a clear line between them. If you could organize the activities in a perfectly lawful way, there's no need to set it up in this complex way and in using secrecy and using chains of companies. So if Apple stopped using jurisdictions like Jersey or even the Netherlands in this dodgy kind of way, then we could say, well, their activities were perfectly legal. But the fact that they take advantage of the facilities and use a company that holds itself out both for large corporations and for wealthy people. And Applebee's, the company whose papers have been leaked in the Paradise Papers, is obviously not the only one. There's a range of these facilitators. Some try to be a bit more respectable than others. Applebee is apparently considered a higher range of respectability, which is probably why it was used by Apple and a number of other. We should say it's not only Apple, but a number of other multinationals appear to have used Applebee's facilities. But there's always another one hiding behind them. It's the system that we have to look at. So to limit the concept of illicit flows really to only clearly criminal activities will be far too narrow. It would allow the jurisdictions to say, well, what we're doing is legal. But there's always illegality lying hiding behind apparently legal activities. And the facilities used and the techniques used are the same techniques. There's a network of bilateral tax treaties which are exactly aimed at eliminating double taxation. So if Apple wants to invest in different countries, it can do so directly from wherever its home, its parent company is located and the country concerned. Going through a third jurisdiction, treaty shopping or jurisdiction shopping, is only used in order to dodge the law in some kind of way, whether it's legal, whether it's unlawful, or whether it's criminally unlawful. All of those are the same kinds of activities, and the estimates should try to identify the different components. Now, there are different components. They don't all involve not paying tax. Some of them may simply be to conceal the money or to evade exchange controls, as I've mentioned, evade customs duties. There may be a number of reasons why you would use the facilities. So the estimates have to take into account the different nature of the different flows and their different impacts.